Assalamu alaikum. This is the Sister Salima Muhammad Saturday morning show. And Assalamu alaikum. This is the Sister Salima Muhammad Saturday morning show. And this is Imam Marshall Musa Muslim Abui, the engineer for Muhammad Speaks, New Africa Excellence Enterprise, LLC, sponsored by Brother Imam Murad Muhammad and New Africa Excellence Enterprise, LLC. And this particular broadcast that you are going to hear is a replay of an interview done by Sister Salima Muhammad, in which she interviewed me as the eldest living male descendant of the Honorable Booker T. Washington. And so we'll go ahead now and proceed with the recorded interview. Thank you for listening.
About that, and maybe the ironic thing about that is that I've been told this all my life, but I was told this even as a boy, that I looked just like him. But even more importantly, I am still to this day, at least up through my generation, the only descendant of Booker T. Washington that has his eyes. You know, he had blue-gray eyes, and I'm the only one of his descendants, at least up through my generation, that had those eyes. So in addition to looking like him, I also had his eyes. So from the very beginning of my life, not only my grandmother, who was his daughter-in-law and who loved him dearly, she had only been married to my grandfather for a little over a year before he died. But he had a home, a beautiful home built for her as a wedding present for her and his son. And I grew up in that home. And the story we were going to get into that occurred in that home. But from the very beginning of my life, even as a very little child, I was told that I was special because I looked like my great-grandfather and I had his eyes. So I was actually groomed to carry on his legacy from birth, basically. And so when I was 8 years old, many of the boys in my neighborhood had been given bicycles by their parents, normally on Christmas as a Christmas gift or a birthday present. And some of them had been given bicycles before I got mine, and I wasn't jealous of them, but I really wanted a bicycle very, very bad. And back in those days, bicycles were precious. And we didn't borrow each other's bicycles. That wasn't even thought of, because everybody knew that a person's bicycle was part of that person, so to speak. And so not having a bicycle, I felt left out as I would see some of my friends riding around our neighborhood. And I didn't actually save the money for the bicycle. I begged for the bicycle. But my father had grown up in a very poor family, and even though he made good money in his profession after he got out of the Army, he had begun an insurance agency before he went into the Army, and he picked it up after he got out of the Army, and he was doing very well. But he did not believe in giving a lot of gifts to children, because when he was growing up, most all of the people he knew were very poor, and they just didn't have a lot of gifts given to them, and he did not want to give me a bicycle at first. He wasn't stingy, but he just didn't want me to be soft. He didn't want me to be spoiled by just putting out my hand and getting whatever I asked for. On the other hand, my mother loved to give presents to people, but my father would not allow her to buy a bicycle for me until I got to be 8 years old, and he finally, either he or my mother or the two of them together, bought me this bicycle. It was a Shelby Flyer, which if the person wasn't, you know, familiar with bicycles from the 1950s or so, they wouldn't understand how important, but that was one of the best bicycles. And it was beautiful. I was so proud of it. And I just loved to race with my friends. We would have these little races, and it was just so much fun. Well, anyway, I was with my grandmother one Saturday morning. That was cleaning day. Grandmother cleaned regularly, but Saturday was the big cleaning day for her house, and she always let me help her do things around the house, including the cleaning. It just so happened that this particular morning, I was assigned to clean the front hallway, and the doorbell rang, and I peeked outside, and there were two people standing on the porch. One was an older, middle-aged gentleman, and the other was a boy, a teenager, that in my opinion was probably around 16, 17 years old. I'm not sure, but somewhere in that time frame. They were very well, you know, nicely dressed, and I went and I found my grandmother, and she was somewhere in the back part of the house, and I said to her that there were some people on the porch, and she had heard the doorbell ring, so she had begun to come towards the front anyway. Now, let me explain something significantly. My grandmother was a widow. She'd been a widow for quite a number of years. My grandfather had only lived to be about 49 years old. I don't know exactly what disease he died from, but I believe he had diabetes. But at any rate, she had raised four daughters alone, so she was very security conscious, having four beautiful daughters and being a beautiful middle-aged lady herself. You know, she was very security conscious. Remember, we're living in the middle of the Deep South. This is what we would call Klan country. And it was very, very, very dangerous for a beautiful black woman, even if a woman was not that attractive back in those days, because white men would freely take liberties with African-American women, and there were no consequences. So I didn't find out until later that my grandmother had a pistol. But I couldn't blame her. When I found out, I was in college, maybe high school, and I understood that she needed protection. But one of the things that she did to protect herself and her family was that she kept the front hallway darkened. Okay, at night, she would turn on a dim light. But in the daytime, she did not turn on any light. And she had her front screen painted black. So even though she could look outside from inside and see who was on the porch, the people on the outside could barely see on the inside. And this is very significant. And I'll say this. The person who was standing there, the older person, was Mr. Elijah Poole, also known as Elijah Muhammad. And the person standing next to him was his son, Wallace Muhammad. When my grandmother came to the door, she cracked the door open, but she did not unlatch the front screen. But I could see these two people clearly. And so the older gentleman announced himself. He said, "My name is Mr. Poole, and I'm looking for Mr. Washington, Mr. Dave Washington." That was my grandfather. My grandmother said, "Well, he's not here. He passed." While they were having this exchange, I'm looking at the younger man, and I was very fascinated by him because he had a special look. Now, let me just say this. When I was a little boy, about 4 years old, my mother put me into the Catholic kindergarten. I was the only kindergarten in that town. And so part of the education of the children in the Catholic kindergarten was to learn about Jesus. I mean, learn a lot about Jesus. But that was great for me because around that same time, I had started reading the Bible. And my mother had employed a lady to watch me, during the day because my mother was a school teacher. And so this lady not only watched me, but she also did different tasks, around the house. I remember her doing the laundry and ironing clothes. But she liked me a lot. I was her special charge. And so I would ask her a lot of questions because I was very, very inquisitive about many things. So I had found this Bible in the house, in the living room, which I do believe my grandmother, who was a Baptist missionary, had given to my parents as a wedding present. And I started looking through the Bible, and there were a lot of colorful pictures in the Bible. It wasn't a large coffee table Bible. It was a standard size Bible, but it had a lot of pictures. And some of the pictures were of young men, like, for example, the prophet Samuel, the young David, and even the young Jesus Christ. And even though I was only a boy, I could identify, with these young men. There was something special about them to me. And so I would ask the lady questions about these people, and she would teach me. I developed this, especially she would teach me about Jesus. So I developed this very special love for Jesus as well as for other, really good people. And there were a lot of good people in my life. Tuskegee was full of very, very special, good people. I'm talking about the African-American people that taught and worked at the Tuskegee Institute. So I was surrounded by good people, and when I learned about Jesus, he was the best of the best, of course. And I'm not talking about the Jesus that was crucified. I hadn't got to that point. I was talking about the Jesus that helped his father do carpentry work and was just an all-around really good boy. And so I had developed a certain attachment to that type of character, but the boys in my neighborhood weren't like that. They were rough and rowdy, rough and tumble guys. The older guys were starting to like girls in the way the boys develop into liking girls and so forth. But, I still was looking for that saintly type of person because that's the kind of person I wanted to be. Now, I'm only 8 years old, so I hadn't started really liking girls that way, but I was wanting to find somebody that I could be inspired by that was like Jesus. And so when I looked through that screen and I saw this, he wasn't a boy as such, but he was a teenager. His countenance, his aura, the whole vibe, as we say nowadays, that came from him was Jesus-like. You know, it connected with everything that I had learned to feel in terms of the character of Jesus. And I have been wanting to find someone in my neighborhood like that, that I could be friends with, because that's the kind of person I wanted to be, really wanted to be. Now, there was nobody around like that. When the gentleman said his name was Mr. Poole, well, I knew a family, Poole family, and they had four boys. But they were nice guys, but none of them were like that. None of them had that kind of character. So I thought that this young man was related to them. And so after they left, I began this search. And I went around the neighborhood, maybe thinking maybe there were some other pools that I didn't know, and because I didn't know where these people came from. So I'm looking all over the neighborhood for this young man, for this boy, because I said, even though he's as old as me, maybe he can be my friend. Because that's what I was looking for, a Jesus to be my friend. But I couldn't find him. And it wasn't until 1965 or 64, right around the time that Malcolm X broke with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And I believe that Jet magazine carried a picture. And it was actually a picture of Malcolm X and Imam W.D. Muhammad, which at that time he was just known as Wallace Muhammad. And when I saw that picture, my heart leaped for joy. I said, that's him. That's the person that I saw that day. Now, mind you, I'm 21 years old, so this has been like 12 or 13 years prior that I'd seen this man, but I recognized him immediately in that picture. I said, that's the person I've been looking for. Okay, now, when I got to be around 12 years old, 11 or 12 years old, you know, my father used to buy the Pittsburgh Courier newspaper every week, came out weekly, and he would bring it home. And by this time, I'm a very, very avid reader. I mean, I was reading everything. I was reading, I was told, at college level, you know, when I was that age. Because my mother was an English teacher, and she encouraged me to read. And she used to tell me after I got out of school to go to the library, because she worked on the campus of Tuskegee Institute, and the library had a children's reading room, and the lady who was the librarian used to recommend books for me to read. So I would sit there for an hour, maybe a little more than an hour, reading until my mother got off work and would give me a ride home. So I was reading the Pittsburgh Courier, which had a column in there by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And by this time, I had begun to read up from slavery, and I had, you know, learned things about what my great-grandfather had taught. And mind you, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was not allowed by the editors of the Pittsburgh Courier to put the language in the paper that we heard at the mosque or the temple about the white man being the devil. They would not allow him to print that. He could print things about the injustice that white people were doing to black people because other writers were writing about that. He could print about Islam being the natural religion of black people. That was fine with them, okay. But he couldn't print about the white people being the devil. But his teaching still was pretty radical, very strong anyway, because he was afraid to say what he felt and what he knew about the treatment of black people by white people. So my father was militant. You know, he grew up and he went to Morehouse College, and a lot of the intellectual Morehouse men became famous militants, including Martin Luther King, but who my father knew very well, and I'll tell you maybe some other time about that really special relationship. But the point of it is that when I read the articles about that Elijah Muhammad wrote, I was really fascinated by him. And so I told my father, because the Pittsburgh Courier was looking for people to sell the paper, and I told my father I wanted to sell the paper. And he had to sign for me to be able to sell the paper to make sure that they got their money. And so I started selling the paper. And I was excited about, as we call it later when I was a paper captain for the Nation of Islam, pushing the program, pushing the paper. And so after school, after I finished playing ball with my friends and studying, I would, and when the people got home from work, I would take my papers and I would go from door to door. And I'm only 11, 12 years old, and I'm going from door to door. And I wouldn't stop until either I sold my last paper or it got too dark and I knew my mother would be worried about me. So I became an enthusiastic soldier, as we would call it later, you know, for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, even though I was only 11 or 12 years old. So anyway, to bring this story to a point, to a close, so I have been a devoted follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad since I was 12 years old. I didn't go to any temple. I never heard a minister of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad speak until I was in my 20s. But I believed in what he was teaching because it sounded like my great-grandfather, who I was born to follow almost religiously. And then later, because of his special character, at least what I felt was his special character, then I became a follower, a supporter, and an imam under Imam Wallace D. Muhammad. I hope I've covered your question.
Yes, sir. Oh, how remarkable. Thank you so much. The next question pertains to education. However, brothers and sisters, this program is brought to you by New Africa Excellence, where Rod speaks. I want to share with the listening audience before my question your educational background. Imam Musa holds an associate in arts degree in humanities, a bachelor's of arts degree in educational philosophy and African American history, a bachelor's of arts degree in English creative and professional writing, a master's of education instructional technology degree, and a master's of arts in military history. He has completed all the coursework and comprehensive doctoral examination for the PhD in post-secondary education. He is currently earning a college teaching doctorate at Grand Canyon University, Phoenix, Arizona, in addition to pursuing a doctorate in higher education. This is, what is this, a double doctorate here? Leadership?
Well, you're gonna probably, you know, go to the next part next, and then you'll probably say triple doctorate, but go ahead. I think you're going to say the next part.
I see. Leadership at Aspen University. Plus a doctor. Here we go with the triple, brothers and sisters. Strategic Security in North American University, Henry Putnam School of Strategic Security. Imam Musa served as professor of history in the University System of Georgia and a professor of history at Augusta University. Augusta, Georgia. He was awarded a certificate of commendation from the University of Georgia for excellence in college teaching. He also served as a reference assistant and research consultant at Reese Library, Augusta University. Wow! My question. In 1995-1996, stemming from the first Million Man March, forming a local organizing committee, my Aunt Rosalind launched what is called the Amistad Bill, specifically an African-American curriculum, public schools in Rahway, New Jersey. And from there, she created a program for the young people entitled the Rites of Passage Program, working with Dr. Asante, Temple University, and Dr. Carr, Howard University. She has since transitioned. May Allah be pleased with her. What is the importance of African American history to our youth?
Okay, first of all, you have my condolences on the passing of your aunt. I'm sorry I never got a chance to meet her. She seems as though she was a very, very, very remarkable person, and I would have loved to have learned from her. But I do want you to slowly repeat that question again because I want to make sure I answer it on point. So could you repeat it once more?
Yes, sir. What is the importance of African-American history to our youth today?
Okay, great. Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, let me say that African-American history is world history. I think it's important for us to understand that. I teach world history. I teach African-American history. I teach U.S. history, you know, as part of my job as a history professor at the university. We don't have a specific course in African-American history per se, but I always incorporate a lot of information about the history of African-Americans even more than what's actually written into the plan curriculum. We have instructional designers that actually do a lot of research and package material together for the courses that I teach. I'm fortunate because that relieves me of a lot of work, but I always add a significant portion in my own classes about the history of African Americans. In fact, I'll just say this and I'll answer your question directly. You know, I'm teaching online now. The environment that we're in now is many, many college teachers. That's how we have to teach because of the COVID-19. But I love teaching online because I get a chance to use a lot of the latest technology. But the fact of it is that just here in the last few months, I added to the instructional designers package a picture of some soldiers that were maybe Dahomian soldiers. Now, of course, Dahomey is one of the kingdoms that went out of existence not long after the slave trade began. But it's historically very important because the Dahomeans were great, great warriors, but they also were great craftspersons in gold and bronze. The statues that you see now that carry the label of Made in Benin, Benin, B-E-N-I-N, Benin is actually the new name for Dahomey. You see, and so, but by that time, their warriors had been, you know, subjugated by the colonials and even other stronger tribes, mostly through the colonialization and the powers from Europe. But they were still allowed to continue their crafts, and so that's why most people know about the Beninese crafts, the bronze and gold, beautiful things, the masks and statues, but don't know about the warriors. But before all of that transition, they also had very powerful warriors, and so I happened to find a picture, a bas-relief of these warriors, and this was done in bronze or gold, I'm not sure which, but anyway, and I posted that on my course website, And I did that so because most of my students are Caucasian, maybe 95% of my students are Caucasian. I have a few African, not just African-American, but actually from Africa. And I have a number of Hispanic students, but I would say the greater portion of them are Caucasians. And they don't know anything about this great, powerful kingdom called Dahomey. They know nothing about the fact we had great civilizations of Muslim people or others. And so these soldiers are dressed, you know, like you might have seen in King David's army, with coats of mail and head pieces of metal and nice, elegant-looking, you know, armor and shields and swords. And I put that out there so that my students, both the black and white students, could see that black people have a history that goes far, far, far back, way before the cotton fields, because that's all that most of the students ever hear in elementary schools, that black people were brought over here in slavery. They worked in cotton fields and other fields and so forth. But no, that's just a short span. The 300 to 400 years is a short span. You know, our history, actually recorded history, goes back over 50,000 years. Historians will confirm this, you know, in the motherland. So the 300 or 400 years is just a dot. So when you take that dot and you put it on the side, the rest of the history is a glorious history. Now, it hasn't always been what I would consider the most kindest history. Some of our tribes were very brutal towards each other. The Zulus, you know, they had to become brutal to try to force the English off of their land. Chaka Zulu was known as one of the most successful but brutal warriors in African history, but yet he was forced to be that way because the people, the English, were trying to annihilate his tribe. But the fact is that I want our people, not just our people, but anyone, but I want our people to understand that we have a lot to live up to. That's the most important point to answer your question. Our young people and old people as well, because we weren't given these role models. I was given the role models because, you know, I was taught that I had to live up to the legacy of my great-grandfather and people like George Washington Carver. Now, I didn't know a lot about some of the other great people that were living and doing great things at the time of Booker T. Washington. I learned later when I became a member of the Omega Psi Phi fraternity when I was in college, that one of Booker T. Washington's contemporaries, Dr. Ernest Everett Just, was internationally famous for his work in cytology and biology. But I didn't know about those people at that point, but I knew about some of the people like Booker T. Washington. And that helped me, and it inspired me to try to live up to the standards that they set. And so I think one of the most important, to answer your question directly, reasons why it's important for our people to learn about our history is because we need to have goals. We need to have standards. We need to be able to aspire to reach the standards that other great people have set so we can be energized to go further. Because what we were given by white people only made us think that we were just supposed to be servants and slaves and never become the great people that we have seen we can become.
You speak about being a member of the Omega Psi Phi fraternity. You were recognized in 2017 for 50 years of service to the Omega Psi Phi fraternity. You were the past president of the National Hill Augusta, Georgia chapter of the International Lions Club, and in 2016 awarded the U.S. Army Public Service Medal for your decade and a half of service as a volunteer Islamic chaplain on the Fort Gordon U.S. Army installation in Augusta, Georgia. I think here is so important. Your service, you're also the author of a book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. And Booker T. Washington for a New America, are we there yet? Just give us an example of what needs to be done to change America for the better.
Okay, that's great. I'm glad you asked that question, because even though I cover this in my books, I'm going to go to a book much, much, much more significant than anything I could ever write. And this is a book called Second Chronicles, and it's part of what we know today to be the Bible. But, of course, when it was written, it wasn't part of any Bible. The Bible just means a collection of books, but it was a book all to itself, you know, written thousands of years ago, but it's still relevant today. And this is my answer to your question, because here we have Almighty God speaking through the writer, the author of the Chronicles. Some say that was Solomon, but at any rate, this is the voice of God speaking. And he says, if my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves, that's the first point, shall humble themselves, mm-hmm. and pray, and seek my face. Now, let me just say this. In Arabic language, there's a word, waj, which many authors translate as face. And so, obviously, one thinks of someone's physical face, you know, on their head. But waj doesn't just mean that. It also means character. And it also means attributes. So if we take the word face, which the English translator put into the Bible, and change it to attributes, that would be a better translation. And turn away from their wicked ways. So there are three things here. First, be called by his name, meaning to be in communion with him, to be part of his communion of righteous people, and humble themselves, meaning to be submissive and obedient to him, and pray, meaning to devote themselves, and pray is another word for worship, to serving him. And then seeking his attributes, seeking to emulate his attributes. Each one of these things is something in that syllabus or that program that we must do, you know, if we want to change America to be better. And then turn, this is the next part, then turn away from their wicked ways. You can't have it both ways. You can't, as they say, my dad used to say, you can't have your cake and eat it too. Either you're going to eat the cake or you're going to hold the cake. But you can't have both.
Yes, sir.
So to have God, you got to turn away from what's against God. You just got to leave it. You can't play with it. You can't say, well, on Friday and Saturday night, you know, I'm going to do what God tells me not to do, but on Sunday and maybe even on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, I'm going to do it. No, you can't do that. It does not work. God does not accept that kind of non-sincere practice. That's the reason why in the Bible he did not accept Cain's offering, because it was diluted. It was corrupted. It was not all the way right. It was not sincere. And so what God says, you got to leave those wicked things. You got to turn away from that. He says, then will I hear their plea. I will hear from heaven. In other words, from my heavenly place, from, you know, my heavenly authority, then I will listen to them, and I will forgive their sin. Meaning where they have, out of ignorance or weakness or whatever, where they have betrayed the trust that I put in them, where they've broken this covenant with me, then I will repair them. I will forgive, in theological language, means to repair. means to get you back right, to heal you, to make you whole again. And I will heal their land. And it's not just talking about the physical land, but I will heal their community. I will make their community a community that's going to be satisfying to me. So I'll just stop right there in terms of that particular scripture. But these are some very key things that seem to be overlooked, even in our religious houses, in our churches, in our community. You know, we have preachers that overlook the indecent, promiscuous behavior of the members of the church. Some of the preachers are involved in that kind of activity. You hear about, you know, preachers that take choir members or even deacons' wives out of town, sneaking out of town on trips so they can have liaisons. See, that kind of stuff doesn't play with God. It doesn't work. And God is not going to repair our community. He's not going to bless us. He's not going to make us successful unless we get all the way on the right side, not just 90%, but all the way on the right side. We got to give up those things. Everybody, not to preach, but I am a preacher, but everybody has some weakness. You know, the Quran says we were created with weakness. The word in the Quran is daifan. And that's part of our struggle. That's part of our challenge, is to fight that weakness. In some religious works, they call that weakness the jinn in us, the undeveloped, uncivilized, aspect. Well, God, he put that in us so that he could work with us to bring us through that, so we could become like Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He said everybody has a jinn in them, and one day his wife Aisha and him got into a little, as husband and wife do, a little discussion. I won't call it an argument, but a back and forth discussion. And and Muhammad, peace be upon him, he told Aisha, he said, Aisha, your jinn is showing now. In other words, you're getting out of the box, And she said, but you say you have a jinn in you too. He said, yeah, but I got mine in check. I made mine be a Muslim. So we have to learn, through prayer and asking Allah's help and working, struggling to tap that, put that jinn back in the bottle, as they say, and control that part of us. That's why Prophet Muhammad said, don't get angry. Because that's when you get angry, that jinn comes all the way out. And sometimes it can make you do things that you'll never be able to recover from. But I'm just saying that, we, as people, as human beings, not just black people, but all people, God created us with weakness, but we got to fight that weakness. And we can't toy with it. We can't say, well, this is my birthday, so I'm going to have a little champagne to celebrate my birthday, when we know that God says not to drink any intoxicants, not just drink intoxicants, not to take in any intoxicants. And I tell a lot of the brothers this, and I hope there's some brothers out there listening. I can see who's called in. I can see every phone number that's called in. But I also know that there are a lot of people. I can check. I got the figures on this, too, how many people listen via the Internet. I can see that. I can see the numbers. Probably if I really wanted to, I can see where in the world that they're actually connected from. But I can tell you, people, this is a global program. I've been engineering this program for Brother Murado, almost three years, and watching, and there's certain days, like especially when Murado's speaking, where the spike goes up real high because people all over the world like to listen to him, and I can tell the way your program is going, it's going to happen with you. But the point of it is whoever's listening, I want to tell you this.
Oh,
a lot of the brothers, praise be to Allah, but a lot of the brothers, one of the big problems that men have, because of a fascination, a natural fascination with the female form, because God gave us that so we would want to have females so we could procreate and have families, is that the satanic forces in the media, they have made it easy for people to see what I would say illicit depictions of the female form through pornography. A lot of men have an issue with it. But I will say to this, brothers, you can't have it both ways. You can't have a loving relationship with your real woman and have another nighttime when you get off from work and your wife hasn't got home yet in encounter with your fantasy woman. You can't do that because God is not going to bless your marriage if you're doing that. You know, you got to stamp out, you got to suppress, brothers. I'm just using that as an example. You know, whatever that thing is reaching up in you, that's saying, come on, come on, come my way, come on, I got this little something over here for you. You got to say, like Jesus in the Bible said, get behind me, Satan. You know, and excuse my language because there may be young people listening, so I'm going to be careful what I say, but I'll use a different word. But when the United States military was trying to bring people into the combat in Vietnam where they knew in advance that thousands and tens of thousands of people were going to be uselessly slaughtered for no benefit to anybody except the big corporations that were selling supplies to the military. And then people were strong enough, some of them were strong enough to say, I'll use the word heck no, because they didn't say heck, they said something. Heck no, I won't go. And that's what you got to do when Satan says, come on over here, watch this pornography, come over here, drink this alcohol, come over here, smoke this weed, come over here, do this and do that. You got to say to the devil, heck no, I won't go. And that's what's going to help our people. And until we get strong enough as a community and as individuals to make that kind of decision, to make that break, we'll never rise up. In fact, we'll go further back into slavery than we were back during the slave days when we were in chains. Because these chains will be chains that won't be able to be broken with laws. So we've got to ask God to help us not to fall. And that's what will make us happy and successful.
Yes, sir. Yes. You are a world traveler, having visited Mexico, Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Japan, Korea, Italy, France, Spain, England, Germany, Austria, Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Morocco, Djibouti, Africa, the Bahamas, the American Virgin Islands, Antigua and Guadalupe. You know, this pandemic has put us in a sense we're all in this together. What is one of the most interesting factors that you find in global arenas in the various countries that you can bring to us today?
Well, you know, as a world traveler, as a student of history, and also because one of the things you mentioned that I am involved in is the study of strategic security, which is basically international relations in a more of a military or power competition struggle. As I've traveled, I've seen the results of power struggles and greed. For example, my first overseas trip was at the age of 18 years old. I enlisted in the Army and I traveled by ship to Korea. Well, on the way to Korea, the ship stopped for several days in Hawaii. And after World War II, Hawaii was built up as the place to go for people that wanted to leave America and go somewhere to a tropical paradise. A lot of money was put into building hotels in Hawaii, and so I was able to enjoy a few days on the Waikiki Beach in Hawaii. And you know, everything is just wonderful in terms of luxury. A few days later, a week or so later, we arrived in Japan, and America put a lot of money into rebuilding Japan. And so you couldn't even see any vestiges, any effects, not with your eyes. I mean, there were people that were still suffering, you know, from disease and from, you know, injuries and things like that for the war. Because remember, the war ended in 1945, and here it is on 16 years later. So it wasn't even two decades later when 61 when I went over there. 62, I guess it was, when I went over there. But the point of it is that when I went to Korea, it was totally different. Because there was still a war going on in Korea. You know, in 1962, the war had not stopped. It hadn't stopped today. There was just a ceasefire, an armistice that had settled things down, but there was still shooting going on. And so South Korea was still devastated. I mean, it was just poverty stricken, you know, and I won't go into some of the details of some of the effects, but it was in terrible condition. Now, that has changed in the last 50 years. It's changed, you know, 180 degrees, but I'm just saying that, not just in Korea, I mentioned that because that's my first experience going down to Mexico and going in, even into Egypt and even Saudi Arabia. You know, everybody sees Saudi Arabia as being this great, rich world because that's what you see in the movies. You go there, first of all, you're going to find that 95% of the people of Saudi Arabia are Negroes. Now, who knew that? I had no idea. 95% of the people in Saudi, well, Saudi means black, so you could see from the name that it must have some relevance to black people because the name of the country is black. But 95% of the population are Negro. Look just like Negroes you would see in Harlem, New York. You go to 7th, you know, Lenox and 7th Avenue, and you, Lenox 7th and 7th, you would see the same people that you would see in Saudi Arabia. So what is it? But they're poor people. See, that wealth doesn't filter down to everybody. You got the royal family with over 100 princes, living in palaces. I was in Dubai, and there were princes or people of this royal family that occupied palaces that took up a whole city block. I mean, I've been down a whole avenue of nothing but these gigantic palaces with one family and maybe an extended family living in there. Then you go on the other side of town, and the people are living, you might think you were in Birmingham, Alabama, in the poorest section of town, with no lights. I've seen this with my own eyes. Because, see, when I would travel to these countries, even though I would be staying in a five-star hotel, I didn't stay in the hotel all day. I'd get up in the morning, and I'd catch a cab or walk to the masthead, and then I would do my business that I was there in the city or the town or the country to do. And then at night, I would walk all over the place by myself. Now, I didn't speak really fluent Arabic, but I could say assalamu alaikum and kafalik and, you know, basically let people know that I wanted to communicate with them, and a lot of them spoke English over there anyway. So I got all out into the neighborhoods, in the ghetto, you might say, as well as into the high-rise places. And I'll tell you, what I've seen all over the world is you have this imbalance between the have and the have-nots because of greed and the lust for power and also what I call the diabolic desire to oppress people that are weak and cannot support or defend themselves. That's all over the world.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that. You wanted to share some specific things.
Yes, I do, actually. Well, you know, I'm going to probably shock some people because unfortunately a lot of people nowadays have forgotten about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. In fact, a lot of people have gone so far as to call him derogatory names. You know, for me, for somebody to call Elijah Muhammad a derogatory name is just like calling the prophet Moses a derogatory name. And why I say that is because Moses had a job to do. He had to break the spell of Pharaoh over his people. He had to free his people to physical enslavement because, according to what I read in the story, the people that were enslaved, they didn't have physical chains on all day long because they had to do lots of different kinds of work. Some of them were craftspeople. Some of them were doctors, surgeons, and builders. So they had to have their hands free. So Pharaoh didn't put them in physical shackles. Maybe if they did something bad and he put them in the jail, but the general population, physically, they were free. Now, they just couldn't go wherever they wanted to go. They couldn't walk up into the palace and decide, I'm going to sit up here at the dinner for the king's guests, unless they were supposed to be there to do some serving, and then they better not get caught sitting down. But they were mentally enslaved because they lusted after the things that Pharaoh had seduced them with. So Moses had to break that connection, that worship of the pharaonic seduction. The Imam Muhammad calls subliminal seduction. Well, some of it wasn't just subliminal. It was overt. It was out in your face, as they say. In fact, when I went to Egypt, the thing that impressed me probably more than even seeing the pyramids at the Giza, which I went inside the Great Pyramid, went all the way down to the bottom. They have a ladder, a long ladder, and you could actually climb down the ladder and go all the way down to it. It might have been something underneath it, but anyway, they say that that's supposed to be the bottom, but maybe they had a hidden chamber beneath it. But the Pharaoh's actual tomb was down there, and so I'm just saying that the thing that impressed me, it really wasn't that so much, because I had seen pictures of the outside of the Great Pyramid. It was the three-story high, maybe two or three-story high statues of Pharaoh on the outside of the National Museum. They had one on each side of the large front. With the big doors and everything, you go up the stairs, and they got, you know, this entryway. But on each side in the front, they had it large statues of Pharaoh.
Mm.
And I had never imagined a statue being so big. Now, we know from archaeology that some of the pharaohs were mere boys. It wasn't even five and a half feet tall. But the people did not know that. You know, they didn't have roving newspaper reporters and photographers with video cameras going around recording what Pharaoh was doing. So the people, they were just given an image so they could believe that Pharaoh was that tall. So they were absorbed in his greatness and his power that was really a deception. So my point is that just as Pharaoh deceived the people with all of these grandiose, spectacular, fantastical images to make the people think he was God and worship him, today we have the same thing going on. We have been raised in America to believe white people are the gods of the universe, that they can go to Mars. And if there's people on Mars, they can make slaves out of them. They could go to Venus. If there's people on Venus, they can make slaves out of them. They have that kind of power. We've been taught to believe that. So as a result, we've also been taught to believe that if we want anything, we have to get it from them. If we want nice clothes, we have to get it from them. If we want a nice car, we have to get it from them. If we want nice, whatever. And Elijah Muhammad did the same job for those that followed him that Moses did for the people, his people, that had been enslaved by Pharaoh. But so many of our people even were followers of Elijah Muhammad that would put their life on the line. They turned hypocrite on Elijah Muhammad. I was reading this morning. Every morning I get up, I'm going to say Fajr prayer. When Fajr comes in, and then I read something from the Quran. And when I was reading this morning, is talking about the hypocrites. And it says, hypocrites are those who say they believe in Allah and His messenger, and then they turn their back on it and say they don't believe anymore. The Quran said those people are going to go to hell. Now, I'm not talking about this big old gigantic cavern like the Grand Canyon, you know, out in Arizona, this field up with brimstone and fire and there's caves and there's the really bad people to torture. I'm not talking about that fantasy. That's Hollywood. I'm not talking about, you know, science fiction. I'm talking about hell on earth, suffering, seeing your boys and even your girls get killed at will by the police that care nothing about human life. That's hell. Or even seeing your grandparent who got COVID-19 being refused a hospital bed because they don't have insurance, where they can't get a ventilator because they can't even get in the hospital because they don't have insurance. Where this white family that's got a good job and has got insurance on the job, their person gets in there. That's hell. And the Quran says that those people, they turn their back on God and His messenger. And you know, another thing, too, people say that Prophet Muhammad was the only messenger of God that we should listen to. No, we should listen to any messenger of God. The preacher, the imam that's up there reading from the Quran is a messenger of God. Let's not get spooky. Message just means somebody delivered a message. The postman is a messenger, but he's not from God. He's from whoever that is employing him to bring the mail, whether it's UPS or FedEx or the U.S. Postal Service. So anybody that's telling you what God wants you to hear, then you shouldn't be turning your back on it. So I'm just going to say this. In the book Message to the Black Man in America, which drew me very close to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in 1969, when I first read this book, I'm going to share something with you. You asked me, I'm going to share it. He says, Honorable Elijah Muhammad says, Islam, what is Islam? Now, I'm going to say this. I know a lot of people listening probably going to have a problem with me saying this. There's nothing wrong with saying Islam. You could say the history. You know what I'm talking about? If you're taking a course in history, somebody says, what course are you taking? You can say, I'm taking history. History of the United States. That's the name of the course. Or you could say, I'm taking the history of the United States. It's all the same. Okay, it's all the same, whether you put the D in front of it or not, it's all the same. Al-Islam is just Arabic. Speak a little bit of Arabic. I study Arabic grammar. And Al just means the. It means the Islam. So what do you say, the Islam or Islam? Mm-hmm. It's the same. Now, the fact is, when you read the Quran, it says Al-Islam because that's the way in the grammar that you designate what is considered to be a proper noun or a distinctive identification of a particular noun, you put the in front of it. But that's not necessary. I mean, it's just that's the language. When the angel revealed it, he revealed it in the best Arabic. In the best Arabic, you put all these fine points in there. But I'm not one of those people that if somebody says Islam and not Al-Islam, that's not going to get me upset because I know enough about the language to understand that it's still talking about the same thing. Okay. But Elijah, he wasn't schooled in Arabic. So he went with what he could basically understand with his not great knowledge of Arabic. So he didn't say Al-Islam. If it had been me, I would have said Al-Islam because I'm a scholar, so I would have gone to that Fusha higher level of speaking. But I'm going to go with what Elijah said. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, what is Islam? He says, while teaching and representing a religion called Islam, which we now know we would say Al-Islam, to you, the important thing to do is to answer the questions. What is Islam? Who is the author? Who are its prophets and people? Such questions could be answered in a few words, or one could make books out of the answers. Briefly, Islam, or Al-Islam, if we will, means entire submission to the will of Allah, God. It is, moreover, a significant name Its primary significance is the making of peace, and the idea of peace is the dominant idea in Islam. The author of Islam is Allah, God. We just cannot imagine God being the author of any other religion but one of peace. And I'm not going to read much. I just want to read this part. Since peace is the very nature of Allah, God, and peace, he seeks for his people, and peace is the nature of the righteous. Most surely Islam is the religion of peace. It is a religion offered to the people to bring about a peace of mind and contentment after the destroyers of peace with falsehoods have been destroyed. The entire creation of Allah is of peace, not including the devils who are not the creation of Allah. And I'm going to fix this, okay, because sometimes when we read stuff that Don Bilal Muhammad wrote, we get caught up in spookism because a lot of it he did not leave with having cleared it up. And so his son, Wallace D. Muhammad, had to come and clear it up. And I'm not going to charge him with leading us astray. I believe he knew what he was doing. But I'm going to clear this up. He said the entire creation of Allah, God, is of peace, not including the devils, who are not the creation of Allah, but a race created by an enemy, Yaqub of Allah. Now, Allah created everything. There is not an atom, no matter what the atom may be of, whether it's of dirt or whether it's of grass or gold or whether it's of flesh or whether it's of vegetation. There's not an atom, or whether it's cosmic material. There's not an atom in the universe that was not created by Allah. That's a fact, okay? And so that's one of the attributes of Allah, is the creator. Okay, so when we talk about Khalik, when we talk about the creator, we talk about the creator of everything. So I'm not going to charge Elijah, but I'm just saying I'm going to clear it up. You know, so then he goes on to say, but a race created by an enemy, which he puts in parentheses, Yaqub of Allah. Yaqub rebelled against Allah, and the righteous people was cast out of the homes of the righteous into the worst part of our planet to live their way of life until a fixed day of their doom. These enemies of Allah, God, are known at the present as the white race or European race, who are the sole people responsible for misleading 9/10 of the total population of the black nation. Yes and no. I'm going to stop right there with the reading. I got to say this. In my travels throughout the world, I have met some of the best people you could ever meet, and I have met some bad people too. And they weren't white folks. I've met some bad white folks. I've met some wonderful white folks. I've met some great black folks and brown folks, yellow folks, and I met some bad ones. Because this iPhone, this weakness, this evil, corrupt germ is in everybody. Trust me. And I would never forget, I'm over in Bahrain, which is part of Arabia. It's a different kingdom. It's an emirate, they call it, because they have a prince or emir who's part of the Saudi Arabian dynasty, but they gave the people over there their separate nationality, and so they have their own government, but they're the same people. It's just a bridge that separates. I mean, there's a waterway and it's connected by a bridge, but I was over in Bahrain, make it long story short. And as I said, I traveled all over by myself, all over everywhere, in Africa, in South America, in Japan, in Arabia, in France, in England, and so forth. So one day I'm walking down the street in this neighborhood. It's not no wealthy neighborhood. I would call it a middle-class neighborhood. But there were shops all up along the street. And this one shopkeeper had these big old giant vats of, they look like big vases, you know. But back in the old days, people would put grain or fruits or water or oil. And these things are like about 3 feet high and maybe about 2 feet across. He had them up on some planks, you know, making it like a little three-tier shelf. And I had a shoulder bag. you know, carry my little things I needed. Little Coke, not a Coke cola, but a little soft drink. Give me a little energy as I was walking. Maybe a piece of candy bar, you know, or whatever, and a handkerchief, and so forth. And it wasn't swinging really wildly. You know, it might have been swinging a little bit. But I passed by this man's store, and I saw three Arab boys coming my way. They were like teenagers. And they passed by me, and I passed by these big jars, you could call them, you know, clay jars or whatever. And as I passed by, behind me, I heard one of them hit the ground and crash. And I'm feeling like I'm in this people's strange country. I mean, I'm in this strange country, and I don't want to make any trouble for anybody. And I said, now, I hope that my bag, which wasn't very heavy, it was actually a canvas, you know, shoulder bag, military-style canvas shoulder bag, but I wasn't in uniform, but I had that bag. I said, I don't want to believe that I hit one of these things and knocked it over. I said, it doesn't seem possible because my bag is not heavy enough to knock over this 3-foot big thing. But I felt a little guilty, so I wanted to clear it up in my mind, so I turned around and went back. The shopkeeper came outside, and he's very angry. And he's hollering, you know, in Arabic, which I didn't understand. I don't speak Arabic all that well. But I knew from his, you know, I could tell he was angry. And I went up to him and tried in my best, you know, Arabic and little English, and hoping he could understand. I didn't do it, sir. I don't believe I did it. I really don't. It wasn't me. He said, I know it wasn't you. It was those boys that passed you by. He said, they've been coming by here regularly harassing me. I don't know why, but he said, you know, and finally they've knocked over one of these things. And you come on inside. Would you like to have a soft drink? Spent about an hour in there. Believe it or not, we were able to communicate. He couldn't speak real good English. I couldn't speak real, but somehow or another we communicated. And he said, and I told him, I said, I'm a Muslim. I would never do that. He said, I know you're a Muslim. I can tell by your character. He said, and I can tell you this. He said, you're a better Muslim than most of the people around here. He said, most of the people around here, they practice Islam out of habit, out of just the way that it's a custom. He said, I can tell you're a Muslim in your heart. Now, the reason I'm saying that, is because I'm not going to call those little boys Yaqub's people. I'm not going to call them made devils. You know, I'm not going to call them no name, but they wasn't white folks that did that man like that. So when I read what I just read, that Elijah said, he was talking to a people who, that's the only bad people that we knew on that scale. Now, all of us knew somebody in our neighborhood that probably wasn't really good. They probably did bad things. When I was a boy, growing up in Tuskegee, we had a boy named Daniel Anderson. When Daniel Anderson was 12 years old, he used to go around the neighborhood burning people's houses down. In addition to stealing boys' bicycles. He tried to steal mine. I told him, I said, we're going to have to fight about this because you're not taking my bicycle, because you already heard the early part of the story how much I love my bike. I said, no way in the world are you going to take my bike, boy. You know, you can burn up people's houses and you can steal, but you're not going to mess with my bike, you know. But Daniel Anderson ended up vandalizing the high school and ended up going to prison, and then he broke out of prison and he came back home, and when people heard Daniel had been, when he was back in town, you know, before that we never locked our screen doors. We didn't have air conditioning back then. So we would, in the summertime, leave the front door and the back door open, but we would leave the screen door open too because, you know, people next door, neighbors, they might want to come in your house and bring you some news or bring you a little gift or something like that. And they knew at certain times of day, you know, after, say, 7 o'clock at night, don't be coming in people's houses and not be coming in people's houses before 10 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, the houses weren't that big, and you could see the people when they came in, so unless you were way back in the back, but the houses weren't that big. But everybody in Tuskegee started locking their screen doors and even shutting their front doors and back doors when Daniel broke out of jail. Now, Daniel wasn't a white boy. He looked like he could have been, you know, part white, you know, because he was light-skinned and had kind of you know, straight hair a little bit, but Daniel was a Negro. So what am I saying? But we did not think of even bad boys like Daniel on the same level that we thought about the Klans. That wasn't just burning people's houses down, because I never heard of Daniel burning anybody's house down when they were home. The white folks would burn people's house down with the people in the bed asleep in the house. And so that's why Elijah called people devils, so that we would stop loving them so much, because we were fascinated. We were totally fascinated. And Booker T. Washington was trying to tell us, look, there's some of them that are all right, and most of them are not, but you don't need to depend on them to feed you. You don't need to depend on them to clothe you. You do not need to depend on them to do anything that you can do for yourself. And that's all Elijah was trying to do, is to disconnect us from that mental slavery, the same kind of mental slavery that Pharaoh had over his people. And that's the reason I will never denigrate, abandon, reject, abnegate, or any other verb that you can think of to betray the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because that man, to me, and that is including Awale D. Muhammad and anybody else, is the man that God sent us to break that spell. Now, we had to have the teaching of Imam W.G. Muhammad. Otherwise, we never would have been able to understand the beauty of Al-Islam, because what we had in the nation was great. Oh, man, it was so great. But you know what? You talked about me going into hiding. No, I didn't go into hiding to the extent that I wasn't seen by anybody. I was in the United States Navy. I was standing in ranks being counted every single day. The government always knew where I was, because if you absent for more than 24 hours, then they put you in a status that you absent without leave. Then they start tracking how long you've been gone. And if you've been gone for 30 days, then they put the FBI on your case so they can find you, because if you had the kind of job I had and were exposed to the kind of top, what they call atomic secrets that I had, they don't want you to be out of pocket. They need to know where you are, because you could be sitting up in the Kremlin telling people stuff like Edward Snowden. So, no, I wasn't in hiding from them. You know who I was in hiding from? I was in hiding from the black Muslims. The black Muslims. Elijah Muhammad told the press, and I heard him on the tape, he said, we ain't no black Muslims. Yet he called us black people. He said, we are Muslim. Muslim is Muslim, meaning we are part of the world community of Muslims. And that's the reason why he told us we could go anywhere without Islam and we would be respected. And I found that to be true. I found that to be so true. In fact, I was in Saudi Arabia, and I was on an Arabian ship, as a guest on an Arabian ship. And you know what? After the dua prayer, all the guys who weren't on duty that was up top side of the ship, because there was a lot of them downstairs watching TV, and that's a whole other story, because what they were watching wasn't what I would have been watching, because the Hajj was going on not too far away from there, not 300 miles away from there, and they had it on TV where you could see the people doing the tawaf, doing the circular ambulation around the Kaaba. Those guys did not even want to watch that. Many of them have even done it themselves. They wanted to watch a soap opera on TV. I'm not trying to put the brothers down, but this is the real world I'm talking about. This ain't no real holy place. This is just a place up on the top of the ship. And you know what I was doing? I was teaching the people, the Arab people, Islam, what Imam Muhammad had taught me, to share with everybody, not just Negroes, black folks, but everybody. So I'm over here in the land of the prophets teaching those Arabians Islam. So what I'm saying, Elijah was right. You know, our Islam wasn't just for the black people, it was for the world. But it's just interesting to me, you know, because of the fact that when he said that we ain't no black Muslims, I thought that was really, really shocking. Yeah, but these black Muslims, they were black Muslims. They were black because they were evil as hell. Excuse my expression, children. I'm so sorry. Please take that back. I'll erase that. They was, well, you know, that place is evil now. It is evil. I mean, we know it's evil, but they were that kind of evil. They were evil as the people in that bad place. And they were supposed to be my brothers and sisters. But not, they were, the sisters didn't bother me. But some of those Negroes, I'm not going to give them the honor of calling them strong black men. Some of those Negroes was just as evil as Mr. Yacoub, supposed to be an evil. And they were after me. Recently buried a real close friend of mine. In fact, he was the first Muslim that I got to know when I came to Augusta in 2001 after I retired from the Navy. And we buried him about 3 months ago. I believe he had cancer. Beautiful brother, Imam Ernest Abir Muhammad. May Allah give him the paradise. And overlook
yes,
his
sir,
father.
Yes, sir, and condolences to him. Yes, sir.
Yes, but you know, I never will forget. We were at what we call the big masjid, the immigrants. I call, still call them the immigrants. They had built this multi-million dollar gigantic masjid. It's as beautiful as anything I've seen in the Middle East. Now, I never have been to Mecca. I hope that I can go in my lifetime. That's up to Allah. But I have seen some beautiful masjid over there. And this place is as beautiful as anything I've seen in the Middle East. It's right here in Augusta, Georgia. And so we would go over there, you know, the African-Americans, we have a community center where most of the African-Americans would go for Juma, which I was the assistant imam over there, so I would teach the, you know, Kutbah Juma for about 4 years. But my main place was on the military base. We had an Islamic center on the military base, and I was the imam over there for, well, I still technically am the imam over there, But the fact is that I went over to the big masjid for an event. It wasn't, I don't think the Eid, but it was another dinner or something. And this brother, Imam Ernest Sabir Muhammad, he say, "You still hiding out over on the military base?" Now, I've been out of the company of those guys since 1975. Now, here it is around 2006, been a long time. And I'm not afraid of anybody a lot, but I will tell you this. I'm a soldier. I've been trained in the United States Armed Forces. So I got something to keep me from being attacked at night. Just put it like that. I got a double alarm system, and I got something else for them if they try to come at me. Because some of those guys were nothing but straight-up murderers and gangsters. And if y'all don't know that, I'm going to tell you, so you will know. Everybody say, "La ilaha illallah, I believe in Allah and his messenger," ain't no good person. The devil can put on saints' clothes. And we had some real evil Negroes that were in a lot of the temples. And that's where I went into hiding, because I wanted to make sure that I lived long enough to find an opportunity to serve our people and to live my full life. And I'm 77 years old, and this happened over 50 years ago, what I'm talking about. Well, maybe not quite, but at least 45 years ago. Yeah, I had to do what I had to do. So I went behind the chain-link fences of the United States Armed Forces, where they had to be cleared to come at me. They had to go through a whole process of having the FBI check them out before they could come at me. And, you know, I go all over town. I go all over the country now, but I'm always looking behind my back. And you know why? You know why? I'll tell you why. Because I knew too much. I know too much. Those people were doing some bad stuff. You heard about the zebras out in California? In 74, I knew those guys. I didn't know they was doing that stuff when they were doing it. But when I found out about it, I say, somebody put them up to doing that. And the same Negroes tried to put me up to doing it. But I say, no, you're not going to get me to do nothing like that. I can guarantee you I'm not doing it because I know God don't like ugly, and he sure don't like us to be out there murdering folks. Yeah, you're talking to a brother that's been around the track. Like I said, I was a lieutenant in the Fruit of Islam. Just because Boogie Watson, my great-grandfather, don't mean I'm no softy. I have been in the military for 30-plus years in combat. So, no, I'm not playing. So that's why I'm in.
It's interesting.
But I ain't really.
It's interesting.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's interesting, but I want to pause there for a few minutes because maybe we're speaking about 30 years ago. I was in an undergraduate program, and I was enrolled in an Islamic studies class that was extremely enlightening. And it was taught by a Caucasian professor who was a wonderful, wonderful human being. And for my final project, I completed an analysis on the wonderful works of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. May Allah be pleased with him. And Imam Warthadeen Muhammad. May Allah be pleased with him. And we had different Muslims in the classroom, along with Caucasians and African Americans. And the professor called me and said, I would like to speak to you before the semester ended. And he said, this is a beautiful work that you did. And not to the extent, but to the stance, if I may, that you just spoke of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's words. And he said, but I want to say this to you. He said, be very careful who you share this with. And I was like, what are you talking about? He said, there's so much hatred. I was like, hatred? How can anybody have this towards the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? That was just unacceptable to me. He says, when you're voicing this, because we had to come before the class and speak, and I must say I brought it. But I did not know there were some other people in the classroom who did not feel the same way. So as you speak of your experience, I had this little introduction, and then he became quite specific. You know, with different areas in the Northeast. I was in New Jersey at the time. He was telling me of Philadelphia, California, the Deep South. He gave me a history because he, as a female African-American Muslim, he wanted me to be aware of what was in our midst and what was out there. So I had a small, teeny, tiny taste of what you're speaking of, Imam Musa. Continue.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that, but I got to tell you, you know, I'm a very, very serious, avid student of history, including the history of the European Caucasians. And there's a lady, she's passed on now, but she was a medical doctor, but she was also a social scientist, a psychologist. She was a child psychologist. Her name was Dr. Frances Kress Welsing. And she developed a theory about the reason why the white people, not all of them, of course, but why collectively the white people basically hate black folks. Some hate them more than others, us more than others. But some hate us so bad that they would like to have eliminated us from the face of the earth if they could have. And others hated us at least to the point where they wanted to dehumanize us and try their very best to do that. And I'm not going to go into the whole scientific theory that she had. But my point is this. There are a small percentage. One of the first things I learned as I began to study under one of the ministers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in 1969 was that on this earth, the brown, black, yellow, red people outnumber the white people 11 to 1. That was very, very fascinating to me because I had never heard that kind of information. As a matter of fact, I'll say this quickly, we're about towards the end of the program. I had just returned to California to attend the University of California. I was actually living in California when I enlisted in the Army in 1961. And then after I finished my time in the Army, I went to Tuskegee for 2 years. And then I went back to Berkeley, and then I went down to Atlanta because I wanted to learn what black capitalism. That was a big, a buzzword back then in 1967. It was black capitalism, and Atlanta was supposed to be the mecca of black capitalism, and I agree with that. There were probably more successful black businesses in Atlanta at that time, in even Washington, D.C., or San Francisco. I'd been in San Francisco, and we had a few, but nothing like Atlanta. So I wanted to study that, and I stayed down there longer than I had planned. I ended up staying down there for a year and a half, and that's where I first actually had a chance to hear the teaching. It was over at Clark, Atlanta University. It was called Clark College then. Minister John Shabazz was the minister in Atlanta, and I went and I heard him. And so I had a friend who had gone to Tuskegee with me, and so in 69 I went back to Berkeley to go to school, but I also got a job working for the Urban League, and at one of the staff meetings that we had, he had his master's degree in social work. I hadn't finished my undergrad work, but they had hired me. I was a junior in college, but they had hired me, and we went to a staff meeting, and somebody said something. They called our people the minorities. That was the common word they used to like to use back in those days for black people, the minority. And Brother Student Minister Don X. King, he stood up. He was one of the regular staff and people, and he said, I need to correct you. He said, we're not minorities. Don't use that term about us. He said, we are by far not minorities. He said, as a matter of fact, we outnumber the white people 11 to 1 on the earth. And I had never heard that before. And I knew him in college because we both went to Tuskegee together. And we became friends in Tuskegee. So when I heard that, I said after the meeting, I said, Don, I said, where'd you get that from? I said, that's fascinating. He says, I got a book I want you to read. He said, I'll bring it tomorrow. And he brought me a copy of Message to the Black Man, and it opened my eyes. Now, my point is this, that the white people know collectively we outnumber them, but they have us mesmerized by the same kind of imagery that I told you about that they had of the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh, these are statues thousands of years old. The Pharaoh built this image of himself as being all-powerful. And they have built this image in our mind through the media and then indoctrinating us as slaves and so forth, that they are powerful. So we don't see our collective power. And even in this country with over 40 million of us, they're all divided, as you can see today, in parts in so many ways. But Elijah Muhammad said, if we would unite, we wouldn't even have to lift a penknife, because our unity would be our power, and we could have whatever we want. I'm just saying They are afraid of that power. They know there's a potential for that. They know if we would have got behind on Elijah Muhammad, nothing on this earth or in the sky could have stopped us from becoming the greatest nation that ever existed in human history, at least in modern writing of history, going back 100,000 years, because what we came through had prepared us to excel, but he's been able to keep us divided. So what he wanted to do was to keep you from promoting that truth that you were promoting, and they will stop at nothing, even though the COINTELPRO supposed to have been dismantled. Don't be fooled. Just because they let you know that they had it going, that's one of the tricks they will use. They will say, well, we used to do this, but we don't do it anymore. Let me tell you this before we close, because we're about at the end, and I want to give you time to do the last part that you want to do. But I want to say this. This doctor program that I'm in just got started in, but I've been wanting to get in it for a while, but I wanted to form a very solid foundation base. That's the reason I studied these other doctoral programs, because, you see, unlike what a lot of people think, I don't think a person should stop in one doctor program just so somebody can call them doctor, because today it doesn't really mean a whole lot just because somebody called you doctor, because you could go to one of these divinity schools and spend 6 months writing a handful of papers, and some Bible school down in Florida where they don't have any supervision at all over these Bible schools, they would give you a doctorate degree, and legally, you could put a doctorate for you. Now, you better not apply for a job at a university doing something like that, because they would laugh you out of there. But if you want to tell your friends or go out in the street and pass out business cards, legally you can put a doctorate for you, but it doesn't really mean what it's supposed to mean. For me, doctor means that you are at the highest elite level in the scholarship in your field for your time, you know. But some people, that's all they want to do is get their doctor so that somebody will look up to them. I'd rather be called professor than be called doctor, because at least that means that I'm supposed to be able to teach something. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you get these people that got their doctorate degree. Oh, I'm through now. I'm finished. I had that mistaken impression, but God straightened me out when I finished all my coursework for my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to brag talking about I was a straight-A student. I might have got some B's, but I don't know it, because about 25, maybe 30% of my class I took pass-fail, and all you had to do was do B-level work to pass. So I didn't see whether I got a B or an A. I just know I passed. But the course I did get an actual letter grade in were A's, because I was serious about learning my field. Then I took my comprehensive exam, and I passed that. You know, and I started working on my dissertation, and I'm like about two-thirds of the way through with my dissertation. But, you know, to be called a doctor when I graduate, yeah, that would be nice. I got Dr. Rose hanging up there getting ready for the ceremony and all that whenever it happens. But I'm not going to stop you. I wouldn't be satisfied if I had 10 doctorates, because every day that I live, I'm trying to get more knowledge. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave. So if a doctor is the highest level of elite learning, then I want to go all the way to the top. I wouldn't be satisfied if I had 20 doctorates, because I just want to know. I want to know. So in conclusion, let me say this. This is a great show, not because you have me on here today, but because of your spirit and what you're doing. And I will tell you this. Don't let anybody turn you against Ahmed Elijah Muhammad. The Ahmed Elijah Muhammad was our savior. Now, I ain't no master for Ahmed Muhammad, and if I had known him, I might have said he saved me if he had turned my life around and made me be who I am today. Elijah Muhammad and his son, Wazdi Muhammad, made me who I am today. I put those two in the same pocket because I benefited from both of them. And I tell you this in conclusion, the reason why. See, the problem that was wrong with those so-called black Muslims is that they had not killed that jinn spirit in them. Some of them wanted money. Some of them wanted women. Some of them wanted big matches. Some of them wanted what Rose was. But a whole lot of them did not want the real, true, and living God in their life.
Yes, sir.
They didn't want to be bound by the divine laws of God. You know, even something simple as that's what Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. See, that's what was wrong with those people. Imam Muhammad had grown up around those people. He knew that was wrong. Was right. That's why he had to break that up and get rid of some of those gangsters that we were calling ministers and captains. And I served under some of them, and some of them were more than that. Some of them was actually killers. I ain't talking about killers of the spirit. I'm talking about some of them was like real killers. Yeah, you know. So
well,
that's why I went in hiding, because I wasn't gonna let them Negroes kill me. And Imam Muhammad went in hiding for a while to himself. Not that didn't nobody know where he was, but he just went off somewhere and said, okay, I'll wait till my time come. Because his daddy told him, said, your time may come, but not while I'm in charge. Because he accommodated those guys for whatever reason. He accommodated those guys. I'm not going to judge him. I'm not going to say. But Imam Muhammad, he knew not to butt those people. So he waited until Elijah Muhammad died. His family fixed it where he could be installed as the leader, because it was up to them to make that decision. They said, well, it's going to be the leader. And then with that, he went all over the country. I was in Los Angeles. When he came down to Los Angeles, we had 7,000 people there, and we ratified him because we needed a leader. We liked the way he sounded on Savior's Day. I wasn't there physically, but I saw the recording on Savior's Day, February 26, 1975. We liked the way he sounded. He sounded like he could take us to the next level, and he did. So, but still don't have anybody take away your love and trust for the Honorable Muhammad. That's all I got to say.
I think that the shock was even me was that my own people, you know, yes, you expect people outside of your ethnic group to challenge you, but people of your own ethnic group, I think that was the biggest shock to me. You know, so, but it, you know, everything worked out fine by the grace of Allah. But it was a learning point for me, and I was like, oh, my gosh, my own people. I think that was the biggest shock for me. Yes, some people outside of your ethnic group, of course, but your own people, my gosh. You know, so it goes back to what we were saying clearly, that, you know, there's good and bad in everybody. It don't matter what background you come from or what ethnicity you come from. These little boys in Saudi, it does not matter. The good of the heart, your association, your connection with Allah matters so that you can discern the truth. One question before we leave. Earlier you spoke about two people who influenced your life. You mentioned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and your memoir, Dean Muhammad. May Allah be pleased with them both. Who was the third?
My mother. I always was guided by my mother to be the best person that I could possibly be. You know, my mother used to get on me. I probably felt the lash, not no really bullwhip type of lash, because she would use my daddy's belt more than a lot of kids, because she would not let me do anything that was not approved by herself and by the society. And she wanted to make sure that I knew that what right was right and wrong was wrong, and you're not getting away with messing up around me. She was old-fashioned, old school. But more importantly than that, she was an example to me in every day of her life. She passed in 2009. May God grant her the paradise. She never became a Muslim, but I'll say this in conclusion. One thing I'll never forget. Shortly after I became a member of the Nation of Islam, you know, she didn't like it because she heard bad things about the Muslims. And press was really out there trying to put the Muslim down, and she was buying into some of that. But after only a couple of months, when she saw how the Nation of Islam had transformed my life so that I was becoming everything she ever wanted me to be. I was a student at the University of California, Berkeley, doing well, but I was becoming the kind of man she wanted me to be. And I had gotten my first Quran. I had written off to the Muslim Students Association, and I got this Quran. I still have it to this day, 50 years later. And I brought it over, and I showed it to her because, you know, once we came to the Nation, we wanted everybody else in our family, especially the Johns. And I went over, and I showed it to her, and I you could see the result, how it had made me change, and how I was, you know, making her happy, being proud of me. She said, can I keep that for a couple of days? I said, yes. I was so happy. You know, she wanted to see it. She might want to read it. And then after a couple of days, she called me. She says, you can come and get your Quran again. Come back and get it. I went over there, and she had, my mother was a seamstress. She had learned seamstress work at the College of Tuskegee when she went to school there. They taught trades as well as academics. She learned to be in high school she learned seamstress. And she had gotten this nice, fine, really high quality linen, not the kind you find on a bed sheet, but something that was really nice and heavy duty. And she had made a cover for my Quran, white linen cover for my Quran. That's how much she appreciated what Al-Islam had done for me. And I think she never converted. She was a minister, a lay minister in the Episcopal Church, you know, so she never converted to something, but she always kept the Quran in her house, in her den or her study, high up on the special shelf, and she always respected me. She gave money, she gave books to the Muslim school in Atlanta where she lived and taught. But I'm just saying that, and everybody should try to please their mother. I mean, God knows that we owe our life to God, Allah, and our mother. You know, she's the one who had to put us with our way. We were cavorting and moving around inside of 9 months, and sometimes banging up against the walls of the stomach because we wanted something.